This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
You are listening to the Dilettantes Podcast.
You're listening on our public feed, which includes a shortened version of this episode. To hear the extended version and get access to our bonus shows, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
Hey everyone, this is Jim Salvucci from the Dilettantes, and welcome to a Million Dollar Bash.
It's that Million Dollar Bash.
Bob Dylan's 31st studio album, Love and Theft, was released on September 11th, 2001. And while some folks have made much of that portentous co-occurrence, for instance, seeing the destruction depicted in High Water for Charlie Patton as an uncanny, if not mystical, counterpart to the tragedy of 9/11, it really is just a coincidence. The album's title is the only Dylan title that includes quotation marks and is apparently derived from historian Eric Lott's book about minstrel shows, Love and Theft, Black-Faced Minstrelsy, and the American Working Class. The album's lyrics are among the first to be heavily researched for references to and lifts from other works, and there are many, perhaps most notably some lines from Japanese true crime writer Junichi Saga's Confessions of a Yakuza. The songs are rich with characters, men and women, real and fanciful, and events, as devastating as a flood and as benign as the sound of fornication in the room next door. And there is humor, including some hardcore dad jokes. Sonically, the album is as eclectic as any Dylan has released, spanning such genres as rockabilly, old-timey torch ballads, and some of the most hard-driving blues Dylan has ever produced. Speaking of production, this one is by Jack Frost, Dylan's nom de production. The album before it was the brilliant Time Out of Mind from 1997, and it would be another 5 years before he would release Modern Times. In the hiatus, he released his genre-defying movie, Masked and Anonymous, in 2003, and published his unreliable memoir, Chronicles, Volume 1, in 2004. Love and Theft, Masked and Anonymous, and Chronicles form a cross-genre trilogy of sorts, all reflecting on memory, transition, and destiny. So I want to introduce our regular panel of Million Dollar Bashers, and we're going to start with Rockin' Rob Virginio.
Hi, Jim. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for having me.
Next up is Nina Goss.
Hello. How is everyone?
Hey, Nina. And we got Court Carney.
Hey, Jim. Hey, everyone.
Grayley Heron.
That's good. That sounds more like a Confederate general, doesn't it? Grayley Heron, which is appropriate for this album. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And then Aaron Callahan.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having us, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a fun time. And one day I'm going to get nicknames for everyone, not just Rob. All right. So I told people at the beginning of this, I didn't plan anything. There's so many things we could talk about. And instead of asking questions and doing that sort of a thing, having all the stuff set up beforehand, I usually have at least a cheat sheet. This time I figured, let's wing it. So let's have some fun with this album. I'm just going to throw the doors open. Who wants to talk about Love and Theft?
Yeah, I'm the one who selfishly suggested this because I had been diving back into the album recently, working on the most recent installment of my Substack, Shadow Chasing. I was doing a concert from November of 2001 that Dylan played at my own campus, Xavier University. And this was his first concert since 9/11, but also his first concert since the release of Love and Theft on that same day. And five of the songs featured in that concert, by far more than any other album, were from Love and Theft, and they were awesome. They were the highlights of the show. And so I've been thinking a lot about this album. Way back when Jim first interviewed me for the Dilettantes, and we focused a lot on my book on Time Out of Mind, Jim asked me, what was your first reaction to Time Out of Mind? And I loved it from the start. But Jim, I think like a lot of folks, it took a while to warm up to the album. I came to appreciate it, but not immediately. That's my experience with Love and Theft. I love it now. I didn't totally love it immediately. I thought some of the songs, his voice didn't sound awesome. I thought I could appreciate the variety of musical styles, but a lot of those musical styles just didn't seem like something I was that into. Bing Crosby era music. And so it took a while for me to appreciate it. And weirdly enough, by far my favorite performance in that 2001 Xavier show is Sugar Baby. And I actively disliked Sugar Baby when I first heard it. I thought it sounded so morose and it sounded so bitter and it sounded virulently misogynistic. There's no limit to the troubles women bring and you ain't got no brains, no how. I just didn't like it. But I've come to appreciate that song, Sugar Baby, on multiple levels, partially as a kind of dialogue with Doc Boggs' Sugar Baby. But I also think I've just come to embrace what a great vehicle it is for Dylan's vocal performance. And though the version on the album is good, I mean, that version at Xavier is great. And it's great in the way that you can appreciate, say, Sir Anthony Hopkins playing Hannibal Lecter or James Gandolfini playing Tony Soprano. You don't like the character, but you can appreciate what a great performance it is and how much it gives a great performer to work with. And I feel that way about multiple songs on this album. But Sugar Baby, I think, is the one that the pendulum has swung the farthest for me from actively disliking it to now really appreciating it as one of Dylan's great vocal performances.
Yeah, I like how you talked about the character, right? Because he's playing a character and he does that throughout this album in a variety of ways. I is never Dylan in this album at all, which is true of a lot of his songs, but really decidedly in this album. And as I mentioned in my intro, this is an album that's just full of characters. In my first experience of it, almost the opposite. Now, I have to say, I was all turned around by the events of 9/11, having lived in DC at the time. We were a little concerned. So it was hard for me to get into it the first little bit. But once got beyond that, I was totally into this album. And I've only come to love it even more. It's one of my favorite Dylan albums of all time. What else do we have to say?
I think it's interesting that Grayley picks up on Sugar Baby because that was the one that I was going to spend some time with. It's such a great fucking song. Like, it really just is. I hadn't listened to it that much. I think those 2001 shows, there's some great bootlegs. I think Grayley, you're absolutely right. It takes a different sort of thing going on a lot. But I've been not connected to this, but throughout February, I was reading a lot of James M. Cain and then Raymond Chandler, who I've never dug into. And so I was reading The Long Goodbye, which is, there are some issues with that book. I know it's reading in 2024, but I'll say straight up, that is just the most stunning novel I've read maybe in years and years. But then going back to Sugar Baby within the context of that, it's like, this is exactly the same sort of patois, the same language, the same character building, the same scene building. And I mean, we can go back to Sugar Baby as a theft, as a musical theft. We can go back to Sugar Baby as a borrowing. I think there is an entire book length exegesis on this song in terms of what he's doing with Love and Theft with that song combined with others. But I was just really blown away returning to this record that I had always liked, but I hadn't really listened to it in a long time, and just realized just every single song is like worth revisiting. I'll also say, I don't know the last record other than this one where he plays all of those songs live. Like this album, all the songs become part of the live set. Some of these songs become massive posts in the live world for the next couple decades. Like he really does. Like, I mean, some of those songs he's playing 800 times. So every song gets played. That's not the same you can say for a lot of his other records. And they all become live performances and they all become something maybe a little different. But I was really happy to go back over the next last few weeks to look at this record.
Yeah, I had fun listening to it in preparation for this as well. And it always just blows me away. And Sugar Baby is one of his great endings. And for an artist who produces so many great album endings, that's saying something.
Grayley, listening to the album again and thinking about it, it made me think of Grayley's Time Out of Mind project and how these two albums, and also Grayley's saying that it's resistant to love when you first hear it. And Time Out of Mind and Love and Theft, it's with Time Out of Mind that he introduces this sudden antiquarian timeless world, allusions and references that you're lying if you say you get them all. Sean Wilentz would be lying if he said he got all the references and Love and Theft. And so there really is this feeling that there's an understory, there's a coherent understory to these records, and that vexation of trying to locate what the subterranean narrative and the ground that the reality of this life that's being portrayed in the albums is really interesting to me. This pull to find the metaphysical narrative behind it. And I did, listening to it again, I was struck by how carefully and terrifically he creates this character, this persona who alternates between brutality and flippancy and sentimentality and arrogance. And really, the brutality and the sentimentality in this album are so striking and create such a character who, to me, in Sugar Baby, and I heard the most amazing performance of this in Glasgow, of all places, just breathtaking. If you find November 2005 Glasgow, it will blow your mind. So again, that, and he's in Sugar Baby, I hear this character who's been just fighting with himself and everything around him, exhausting himself. He's depleted in Sugar Baby. And remember that Gabriel blows his horn, and then what's the next thing we get is Thunder on the Mountain, the sound. So I found that really interesting, this pull to narrate this world that he gives. So I'm done.
So Nina, when you're talking about a character in the album, are you saying there's one coherent character, maybe a speaker or a narrator of some sort?
See, that I felt a coherence. I felt this time around that there's such a pattern of desire and exhaustion and really brutality and the minstrels like humor throughout it. And I think we will, I'm sure we'll get to talking about what this has to do with plot and love and theft. But I did feel a man trapped and exhausting himself throughout the album.
Wow, that's a great quote. A man trapped and exhausting himself. I love that.
And I think the sentimentality and the brutality go hand in hand. They absolutely go hand in hand. I mean, what is sentimentality but a kind of emotional elision of the brutality that subtends life in America?
You got to elaborate on that, man.
Well, I mean, to be sentimental is to idealize a past, is to idealize. And I mean, you get that in By and By, you get that in Moonlight, but then there are always creeping into those songs the hint or the trace of the brutality of American life. And I think, I mean, for me at least, and I won't go off into theory land, I've got a lot of different ideas here about intertextuality. The quotes around love and theft for me mean much more than the title, but the love and the theft of African-American musics that Dylan, I think, is really exploring in this album. The minstrel show both sentimentalizes the plantation slave, but then, of course, the whole act of sentimentalizing the past in that way is a brutal dehumanization. And so you can't take the two things apart. They're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, and there's something like that in Mass and Anonymous too, right? There's that sort of nostalgic feel to it, yet it's set in some sort of weird dystopian future, I guess, or present. The carnivalesque aspects, literally a carnival, but very old-timey. The dumb jokes, some of the acting, some of the characters, that same idea, but it is a brutal movie. It ends with a murder and an arrest. Ravi, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your theories. I want to hear about the quotes. Sorry.
Well, I mean, for me, I'll anchor this in an anecdote. It dovetails with my current book project on John Wesley Harding. But what's interesting to me is that the intertextual nature of this album, and I mean that in, well, the intertextual nature of this album, when I was reading, and I love Michael Gray, and I love his book, Song and Dance Man, but he's got this chapter called Even Post-Structuralists Ought to Have the Pre-War Blues. And he does a really generous reading of Stephen Scobie and Aidan Day, the only two scholars that really take post-structuralism and Dylan seriously. But what he does is he critiques Aidan Day for using jargon, which is dismissive. It's not really the point here. But then what he does in that chapter is he provides these exhaustive footnotes, this just page after page of footnotes that trace and track every possible blues reference that Dylan is making. And the problems present themselves for Gray in this way, I think. For one, his plethora of allusions and intertextual gestures on Dylan's part strengthen, I think, and doesn't weaken a need for a kind of more involved critique of this intertextual artist instead of just tracking down sources and doing the Scott Wormuth sort of thing, right? And secondly, what he does in citing all of these blues texts is ignores theorists like Houston Baker Jr. who look at the blues as a, if I can quote him, the blues as a, at the intersections of experience where roads cross and diverge, the blues singer. This is Houston Baker Jr. from his book, Blues, Ideology in African American Literature. The blues singer and his performance serve as codifiers, absorbing and transforming discontinuous experience into formal expressive instances that bear only the trace of origins, refusing to be pinned down to any final dualistic significance. It's an opening up. Even as they speak of paralyzing absence and ineradicable desire, their instrumental rhythms suggest change, movement, action, continuance, unlimited and unending possibility. Like signification itself, blues are always nomadically wandering. Like freight hopping hobos, they are ever on the move, ceaselessly summing novel experience. And so for me, I think what Dylan is doing on Love and Theft is really exploring an intertextual poetics in order to address the oft-silenced, but nevertheless present languages, expressions, and primarily through the blues for Dylan, the expressions of African-American voices, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure does. And speaking of jargon, just for those folks out there who haven't immersed themselves in textual studies for their entire careers, the term intertext is beyond just a synonym for allusion. It's not just a textual reference, but an intertext is an interaction. It could be on purpose. It could be by accident. It just happenstance, but it links the two texts. That inner is very important. So if there's a reference in one work that to another work, whether intentional or not, it can be, we're suggesting that there is something there connecting their meaning. It's not mystical, but it is interesting.
And it destabilizes the subject. And it also is a term that's often used in Dylan studies to just mean allusion, literary allusion.
Right. Which isn't incorrect in itself, but not. Yeah.
Right.
Can I put in here with something that is right with what Rob is saying? And it's something that I found in Lott's book that really speaks to what Rob is talking about and what the album's Time Out of Mind, specifically in Love and Theft, opened up in Dylan, this complex relationship to the blues and Black music. Because I really think this is, and then we don't have to talk about this stuff any, but I really wanted to. So Lott writes, but with antebellum blackface performers, a set of racial attitudes and cultural styles that in America go by the name of bohemianism first emerged, and there was a utopian or emancipatory moment in their often clumsy courtship of Black men. I am not interested in romanticizing those performers. While I believe they were to some extent drawn to, quote, Blackness, unquote, this fact should also interrogate the racial logic usually hidden in our romantic notions of the bohemian, the beat, capital B, and the hipster. We ought to recognize the degree to which blackface stars inaugurated an American tradition of class abdication through gendered cross-racial immersion, which persists in historically differentiated ways to our own day. So my question is, what, and even when Lott was interviewed and talked about how do you feel with Bob Dylan naming his album after you, and he talks about the appropriation and he excoriates Michael Bolton and these appropriators who are clumsy and cheapening the original material. And he says, oh, but Bob Dylan is working with this at a different level. And I think, why does Bob Dylan get this special treatment in this realm? This is a really pointed and rich critique, I think, that Lott is giving. And I get that the text is dense and may not travel that well over the in the pod sphere, but what, there's a way that we exempt Dylan or we valorize his, the appropriation work that he does. And I'm curious about him. We give him this pass because he's Bob Dylan and he's a singular magnificence upon the planet. Is that's why, like, everyone's nodding. I guess that's why. Okay, I'm done with the theories.
Because he's Saint Dylan. I don't know. I'd love to hear a response to Nina there.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode and get access to extended and bonus episodes from this and all of the other shows on the network, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
Thank you for listening to the Dilettantes Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to FM Pods to hear the complete podcast.